Michael Misha Grunbaum enjoyed a carefree childhood playing games and taking walks with his father. All of that changed forever when the Nazis invaded. The Grunbaum family was forced to move into the Jewish ghetto in Prague. Then after a devastating loss, Michael, his mother, and sister were deported to the Terezin concentration camp. At Terezin, Misha roomed with 40 other boys who became like brothers to him. Life in Terezin was a bizarre, surreal balance. Some days were filled with friendship and soccer matches, while others brought mortal terror as the boys waited to hear the names on each new list of who was being sent to the East. Those trains were going to Auschwitz. When the day came that his family's name appeared on a transport list, their survival called for a miracle, one that tied Michael's fate to a carefully sewn teddy bear and to his mother's unshakable determination to keep her children safe. Michael Grunbaum is sharing his story now in the new book, Somewhere There Is Still a Son, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Grunbaum to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Give us an idea of ultimately the story that you wanted to tell. And in writing this book that you thought was important for people to know, and especially young adults and children.
Well, this book is about my teenage years in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and then later in the concentration camp named Terezin, which was just north of Prague. But a lot of people these days, especially in this country, are really not aware of what was happening there. So that's why I decided to do it. I am 85 years old. I finally got around doing this. But the reason why I did it was because I inherited an album that my mother made of the memorabilia from Terezin. And when I became 80, I decided I should do something with this album, and I donated it to the Holocaust Museum in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the curator that came to my house to look at it couldn't believe her luck, because these days all they get is maybe one document or one letter. But here there was a whole array of documents and letters and photographs and coupons and tickets and everything else. So she was so excited about it that she presented it to the entire board in Washington. And because they got all excited, I got excited. And so I sat down and I wrote a children's book. And I tried to tell the story, narrate, had the bear that saved our life. So this was a stuffed bear that my mother made, and the story is in the book. But at any rate, that bear saved our life, and I had him narrate the story, and I tried to get somebody interested in publishing the story as a children's book. And for 2.5 years, I tried all kinds of literary agents and publishers, and nothing happened. Nobody was quite interested in it. A couple of people responded and said, well, children that play with teddy bears are not ready to learn about the Holocaust, and those that are learning about the Holocaust don't play with teddy bears anymore. So, so because of that, there was a small window, and nobody wanted to take the risk of putting some money into it. So the bottom line is that I was, after 2.5 years, I got nowhere. And then suddenly, out of the blue, I received a phone call from the editor of Aladdin Books in New York. And she said, well, would you consider dropping the idea of a children's book? And instead, we would like to send one of our writers to Boston to interview you, not just about that one episode, but about your life under the Nazis during the Second World War. So I said, okay, let's try that. And as a result of that, they hired Todd Sacklowe, and he did a fabulous job. I never imagined that anybody that did not have the experiences that I had would be able to so immerse himself so well into the age of the 12-year-old boy living under the Nazis, and he did a superb job. And so that's how the book came about.
You write in the book about
at Terezin, you're rooming with 40 other kids, with 40 other boys who who became like brothers to you. And it's very bizarre and surreal, you say, because some days were white, they were filled with friendship and soccer matches, and other days were, as I think we would expect, terrifying.
Right. Well, the terrifying part is when, from time to time, the Germans decided to send some people to in trains to the east. Nobody knew what the east meant. Nobody had ever seen anybody come back. But eventually we found out that this was an extermination camp that we were being sent to. It was Auschwitz. And what happened was that my mother had an agreement with her sister-in-law that if one of them were deported and had an opportunity to send a letter or a card back, if no matter what it said, because they knew darn well that the censors would look at it, but if the slanting was up, it meant the place is better. If it was down, it was worse. And so it just so happened that my aunt was deported, and she was able to send a postcard saying that she was already working as a seamstress, because she never worked as a seamstress before. So we knew something was up. And then the slanting was down instead of up. So my mother knew that she had to do everything that she could to keep her and her children in Terezin and not be sent away. So that's what happened. And I can tell you that last episode, which is the one about the bear, we were in these transports about three times, and I was in the transport four times. And each time, my mother was able to pull us out. This last time was in October 1944, when the Germans finally decided that they would just about liquidate the camp. So they sent 18,000 people on these transports to the east. This is out of about 30,000 who were there. So we, needless to say, got a summons, and we were already in the assembly area. And then what happened was that my mother, we had our number was about 1350 out of the 1500, so we had a little time. And my mother ran to the arts department where she was working, and she talked to her boss and said, look, remember we got that order from the Nazi who was supervising us for to deliver him some teddy bears for his children and his friends' children for Christmas. This was in October. But you have to tell him that it's not going to get filled because I'm being deported. So he immediately went to the SS man and told him what my mother said. And so the SS man thought about it for a while, and he said, all right, pull her out. And the boss said, well, yeah, but if she has two children, and if they go, she will go with them. All right, so pull them out as well, but nobody else. So, okay, so she ran back into the assembly area and went to the registration desk and said, okay, here's a slip of paper signed by the SS man that we are supposed to be excused. And the man took us out of the list. And then my mother said, can we leave now? And he said, no, you can't leave now. You have to go upstairs into the second floor and wait in one of the rooms over there until the train departs. We said, okay. So we picked up our luggage. By that time, it was only one suitcase and a knapsack. You got to understand that before the war, we had a large apartment, a lot of books, a lot of artwork. We had a car. Nobody else had a car. We had a cook, and we had a governess. Now suddenly we have downsized to a suitcase and a knapsack. And so we walked up the stairway and looked in the first room. It was completely filled. We couldn't fit down there. We went into the second room, the same story. In the third room and the last room, away from the stairway, finally it was only half full, so we were able to sit there and wait for the train to leave. Well, we waited until everything quieted down. We thought the next sound we would hear would be the sound of the train pulling away. And instead, there was a tremendous commotion. We heard the soldiers running up the stairs, yelling and screaming, 50 more, 50 more. And then they had their dogs barking like crazy with them. And They went to the first room next to the stairway and pulled everybody out of there. There were about 35 people there. And then they went to the second room, and they pulled half of those people there. And you can imagine the scene. Everybody thought they were safe, and instead there's now crying and yelling and screaming and pleading, but nothing helped. They had to march down the stairs and board the train. We in the third room were holding our breath, hoping that the soldiers would not enter our room. There was a small child, so the mother was holding her hand over his mouth so he wouldn't make a sound. And finally, we heard the steps of the soldiers, but this time they were going away. And eventually, we heard the train leave, and there was a tremendous jubilation in our room, of course, because we survived another day. So that's basically the story.
Michael Greenbaum is the author of the book Somewhere There Is Still a Son, telling of his experiences in the Terezin concentration camp. That time in the room, you point out in the book that, I mean, obviously your jubilation, but in just a matter of days, 10,000 people were on those transports.
There were 18,000 people that were sent in 11 trains, most of them about 1,500 people in one train. And what really happened was that just a few months earlier, the Germans decided to bring in a representative of the Red Cross from Switzerland to show them this model camp that we were in, that, you know, we are being treated very well. They walked him by a beautified part of the town that had to be done. And then they walked in by a cafe where people were chatting and drinking coffee. They had never drank coffee before, nor did they ever drink coffee afterwards. But this was all for show. And he attended some operas, and he watched a children's opera, Blundibar, in which I sang. And then he passed by a row of boys, including me, and was handing out, this was the commandant, the guy in charge of the camp. He was handing out sardine cans, and we were taught to say, "Schon wieder Sardinen, Uncle Ram." Again, sardines, Uncle Ram. Of course, we never saw sardines before, and then immediately after they left, they were all collected, never opened up, nothing. So it was ours to fool the Red Cross representative, and he indeed was fooled because he wrote a very good report about the camp.
You write toward the end of the book of just wondering if they'll take your mother, if they'll take your sister, or they'll just take you. You talk about your ears stretched out the door like antennas just waiting to hear boots click. I just can't think of anything more terrifying.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing, that at least we were together, even though it was just for a moment, because once we would have arrived in Auschwitz, well, we probably would have, all three of us would probably have gone directly to the gas chamber, which is what most people have to do. So, it could easily have just been one of us. You never know whether they would take the whole family. Actually, what happened was that my sister, who was 4 years older than I was, she had a boyfriend. And the boyfriend was summoned for a transport, and she decided that she wanted to go with him. And she had a big fight with my mother, and my mother really had to push hard to keep her there, because she kept telling her, "Listen, we don't know where these transports are going. Nobody has ever come back to tell us. So please stay here, and if everything goes well, then you'll see him after the war ends." Of course, when the war ended, she checked all the people that were coming back from the different camps and the death marches and so on, and he was nowhere on the list. He most likely ended up in the gas chambers in Auschwitz. What they did at one time was there was an uprising in Warsaw. They were afraid that maybe there would be an uprising in Terezin. So they announced a transport of 5,000 strong men, that they needed them to start a new labor camp. Well, that was not the reason. They were just they wanted to get rid of possible trouble in Terezin. So these boys young boys, very strong boys, all were sent to Auschwitz, and most of them died in the gas chambers.
Your story after this happened, you emigrated to the United States in 1950. You graduated from MIT and from Yale. You served 2 years in the Army. You worked for the Boston Redevelopment Authority, as well as the Massachusetts Department of Public Works. And then you founded a consulting firm, which is great success. You have a family, a wife of for 50 years, and three sons, four grandchildren. But something like this has to obviously stay with you forever. And I'm curious as to how you look at it, of how it formed you, the person that it made you, and what it allowed you to do in life because your number wasn't called.
Well, one thing I can tell you is that because of the war, I lost 6 years of schooling. So when we returned to Prague, they assigned me to a class, and of course all these kids had gone for schooling all these years while I was not. So it was very hard for me to sort of compete with them. And then after 2 years, it looked like the communists were going to take over. So my mother had the foresight to ask for a visa from some friends, and we left Czechoslovakia. And we spent 2 years in Havana, Cuba, because our quota number hadn't been called. There was a quota program. So we finally arrived in the United States after I finished the high school, an American high school in Havana, and I had to learn English and I had to learn Spanish, but I finished it all, so I speeded things up a little bit. And then when I went to MIT, I finished MIT in 3 years by taking extra courses and studying in the summer. So I got all that, and I sort of ended up by only maybe being one year behind, or 2 years at most. But anyway, you asked me what the lasting thing is from all this experience. I would say two things. One, I learned from my mother all about perseverance. You have to persevere. You cannot accept a no for an answer, because you have to try and see whether you can get a yes from somebody else. So that's one thing I learned, and it's been very helpful to me through my whole professional life. And the other thing I learned is that possessions mean absolutely nothing. We had a big apartment in Prague and before the war, and we had a lot of books, and we have artwork and oriental rugs. We had a cook and a governess, and we had a car. In those days, hardly anybody had a car, but we had a car. Well, now, suddenly, as we were on this transport, we had downsized to one suitcase and a knapsack. And what I'm saying is that I don't take these things very seriously. The possessions mean nothing, really. And I think it's been a good philosophy that I've been trying to tell my kids, and, teach them about that as much as I could.
There is a photo on the back of the book with you and a teddy bear. Is that the bear?
That's the bear, yeah. My mother kept one bear, and she carried it with her to Cuba and so on. And then I inherited it when she passed away.
So that possession must mean a great deal to you.
It certainly does. And, of course, the Holocaust Museum is very interested in obtaining it. But my oldest son has indicated interest, and so I think I will pass it on to him.
Just looking at the title of the book, of Somewhere There Is Still a Son, and I assume that's a feeling you have in the camp, right? That somewhere there is still a son, and we of a later generation could never, even though these stories that you tell certainly help, understand what you went through. But when the generation of your children and your grandchildren, when they have a feeling that there is no son, and a feeling that, well, there's somewhere there must be a son, Is that a fair comparison, or is it just something that we should take that when things are not going well and there things are of concern, that we must persevere, as you indicated a few moments ago?
Right. No, I think that's very true. Do you know where the title comes from?
No, I do not.
In the introduction of the book, there's a letter that my mother wrote. She wrote it about 2 days after we were liberated. And I'll just read to you the last paragraph there. It says here, "We do not know yet how the future will shape up for us." This was a letter she wrote to her friends and relatives abroad that were fortunate enough to leave Europe or Czechoslovakia before the Nazis came. So she said, "We do not know yet how the future will shape up for us. None of our old friends are alive anymore. We do not know where we are going to live. Nothing. But somewhere in the world, there's still a sun. Mountains, the ocean, books, small clean apartments, and perhaps, again, the rebuilding of a new life." It's such a fabulous letter that it's quite appropriate that the publisher decided to use that sentence for the title of the book.
You know, and I did read that, and the letter that is at the very beginning, and it's a beautiful letter, but it is one line of somewhere in the world there is still a sun, as well as mountains and the ocean, as you mentioned, and so now you've always, I assume that you find that it's easier for you to find that sun, I would think.
Right. No, that's very true. I mean, that's another thing. I always kept telling my sons that I have 3 sons, and I always told them that I wish they had the experience of being in Terezin for 6 months or being in the army for 6 months or something like that, because once you've been through something like this, then you can look at life very differently. Nothing will bother you because you've seen the worst. So it can only be up from that point on.
Which we should mention also included the death of your father at Terezin.
Oh, absolutely. That was horrific, you know. What can you do? I mean, they took him, they kept him for a couple of months in a prison in Prague, and then they sent him to the small fortress with a note that said, "RU." In German, it's Rückkehr unerwünscht, or it's the same thing, really, in English, return undesirable. And so within 2 weeks, they send him back dead.
The title of the book is Somewhere There Is Still a Sun. The book is published by Aladdin. It is a memoir of the Holocaust. Michael Grunbaum, I can't thank you enough for sharing the story with us and for writing the book and for the love and the courage that you display within its pages.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Again, the title of the book is Somewhere There Is Still a Sun. It is by Michael Grunbaum with Todd Hasek-Lowy. It is published by Aladdin Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.